I spend 50 minutes on Twitter, and then Mira will like look over at my screen and be like, "What the hell are you doing?" And just see a little tear coming down my eye and my mouth aghast. All right, welcome to Increments. We're talking about the documentary, The Social Dilemma, and more broadly, the question of what the hell social media is doing to our minds. This is a pretty fun one. I think we came at it from very different angles, and both of us had some relatively strong priors about like what we thought about it. Yeah, honestly, I think if you're just like perusing intros to decide what to listen to, I think this is a super valuable one to listen to, especially given the rhetoric right now around social media in the public sphere. Like, you know, this documentary has come out and now everyone's ready to delete every social media account ever. And possibly that's a good idea, but possibly not. And I think we do a decent job here of like just diving into the issues and seeing what's going on and placing the development of social media in a proper historical context, which I think is necessary to really view its effect on us and whether we're going in a good direction. The other thing I'll say is a random point, but if you're not increasing the speed on your podcasts, on your podcast player, you should do that because you can probably think faster than we can talk. In fact, I know you can. And so it might feel weird at first, but seriously, increasing the speed on my podcast player changed my life. You know, you could start with just like 1.1 times speed, 1.2 times speed, something that doesn't feel too overwhelming, but you can easily get to like 1.5 times speed.
How high can you go?
I'm at two, but I also have the clip silencers. Yeah,
exactly. I was gonna
and
say
auto. Yeah, exactly. So that bumps it up, and then it'll automatically. I use Overcast, and it'll automatically speed up or slow things down based on like the cadence.
Oh, that's a nice feature.
And so it'll tell you. So it averages around like 2.15 because of like trimming silences and stuff.
Oh,
so that's really nice. And then the last thing is, I don't even know if this ever made an intro, but you do the music for this thing. And we said that once before, but I can't remember if that actually made it into the intro or if we cut that intro.
I put a little, like, we had this one clip that we never ended up using for the intro, but I just shoved it at the back of the historicism episode because it was such a heavy episode. So hopefully I'll try to do some more of those and put them around. But yeah, I do the music. Cool. All right, man. Let's play the show. Hopefully we're still friends at the end of it. I know we will be. I won't start spewing too much, but it's going to be a really fun debate. But do you want to maybe kick it off?
Okay, so I watched The Social Dilemma. I know you would watch it first. I knew you had strong feelings about it. And I have to grant you that it's a bad documentary. And I understand what you're saying now, that you can really dramatize everything if you bring in the right actors, the right lighting, and the right music. And you can make anything novel appear sufficiently scary, or as scary as you would like. So I'm just going to point that out at the outset. I am not a fan of the style of the documentary. And I don't know what the fuck is with the interludes with the family who's having their issues. But I thought that was a pretty bad way to get across all their points. So I thought the family was incredibly weird. And it was discouraging for me, I think, to see the documentary use those kind of tactics, because I thought the subject matter is sufficiently serious. And I think warrants a serious conversation to be had about it, and therefore you shouldn't be overly dramatizing and like overplaying your hand too soon, because it lends critics such as yourself the upper hand in the conversation already. And if we don't want to lend Vaden anything, it's definitely we don't want to lend him the upper hand. So yeah, definitely not a fan of the documentary, but I do share some of the concerns espoused by a lot of the quote-unquote tech insiders, and thinking through it and like doing some lit review and some reading of the relevant research, I'm still not sure exactly where I fall on some of the questions. I think I'm still much more skeptical of social media and scared of its influences than you seem to be. So I think there's going to be a pretty clear dividing line between us. I think overall, I'm still of the opinion that it's a negative influence, but there are lots of positives that I will attempt to steel man throughout the conversation and positives that certainly weren't talked about in the documentary. So overall, bad documentary, didn't do a good job of Steel Manning the Other Side, and just used effects and music and lighting to basically get across its message.
Yeah.
So that was my general take. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we're talking about the social dilemma. Do you think we should assume our audience has seen it? I know that I've talked to a lot of people in my like private life, and most people have seen it. Most people have loved it. I haven't actually met someone who hasn't liked it. And so I think this is going to be a fun conversation because there's almost unanimous support for it, for the documentary and the movement as a whole. So, yeah, the main thesis is that social media is to blame for pretty much everything. Political polarization due to people essentially being forced to become addicted to social media, then being pumped with political propaganda leading to division. And then at the culmination of the documentary, like Jared Lanier is one of like the wise old insiders. He talks about how like in the next 20 years, if we don't fix this, like we are going to go extinct. So I pretty much view this as the same tech panic that came around with video games and anti-nuclear power and anti-GMOs, anti-vaccines. All of these panics work pretty much the same way, where there's some new technology which comes out and it solves a lot of problems. And it's an utterly transformative technology. It takes care of some problems, but it introduces new ones. So it replaces old problems with new ones. And then typically what happens is people begin to work on them, but then there develops a small subset of people who view these problems as like an existential catastrophe. So much so that we need to not try to incrementally improve the technology, but go back to a time before the technology was even invented. And so there's a long history of this every time there's a new technology developed. And I basically view the social dilemma and the panic which it has caused as this applied to social media. So like when Pinker talks about how progressives hate progress and how there's always fear and doom and gloom, like this is essentially what he is preparing us for. So that being said, part of my like description of that includes the idea that there are legitimate problems here that we need to address, right? But we need to tease out these problems from the hysteria. It's been interesting to see like the evolution of Tristan Harris's career. So Tristan Harris, for those who may not know, is kind of the lead insider in the documentary. And I first heard about him on Sam Harris's podcast like years ago. And now he's recently come back with this documentary. And he's gone from raising legitimate concerns to the full on apocalyptic, it's checkmate on humanity. We're all just spiders being poked and prodded by the tech companies, and we are all going to die. And so this is just hysteria from my perspective. So what we need to do in the conversation is tease out the legitimate concerns and then contextualize them so that they don't give people the impression that this one thing is destroying society and that we have 20 years to live or we're going to be extinct, as Jared Lanier says. And so that's kind of my overall position. But now we need to obviously go into a bunch of the details. But
yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of straw men being thrown at a lot of people here. So just, yeah, to clarify one thing to come to Tristan Harris's defense for a second, you know, he's not advocating that we return to a time before this technology was implemented. He's very clear that like there are a lot of upsides with the technology, and we just want to change the incentive structures for these companies such that the incentive is not to stoke outrage and misinformation, but it's rather to like ensure that our time spent on social media is actually constructive and valuable and increases our well-being instead of decreasing it. And so I don't think he's advocating a return to a previous time. Rather, he's advocating that we change the technology, possibly in an incremental way. I don't think he's given some suggestions of how he might do that, but you know, he's not talking about abolishing these companies. He's not talking about everyone deleting their social media accounts right this moment and the government cracking down on Facebook and Google and Snapchat and forcing everyone to, you know, delete their accounts or whatnot. And so, you know, a lot of these people are not necessarily just saying either we get rid of social media right now or we go extinct, which I think came across a little bit in your tirade there.
Just to respond to that one point, Jared Lanier said explicitly, like, this isn't a straw man. He said explicitly that we have 20 years to live. And then at the end of the documentary, there's like a 5-minute, here's the sentence that says, we recognize that social media has some good things too, right? Point taken that if you ask explicitly, what do you think should happen? They wouldn't say we need to tear down all social media infrastructure and blah, blah, blah. But the rhetoric which they deploy all points in this direction, either implicitly or explicitly. And so I'm just calling attention to the fact that, like, it just freaking irks me, man, because the whole point of Tristan Harris is he's pointing out the manipulation of other people, how other people use psychological manipulation to, and then, like, he has the audacity to do all the same tricks on the viewers. And so,
I'm not sure if he's a producer of the film, is he?
I don't know. That's an excellent point. Okay. But even in like his conversation with Sam Harris, I wrote down a list of all these phrases that he uses. He says like, we're trading exclusively in human futures, that we've created a Frankenstein. It's like a race to the bottom of the brainstem. Like all of this is just language which is meant to cause and stoke fear. And so point taken that if pressed, he wouldn't say that we need to just tear it all down. But the rhetoric which he employs cuts orthogonal to his stated aims.
So, okay, I think we both agree that the documentary itself is over-dramatized.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say beyond that before we actually just dive into some of the claims being made by the insiders?
Yeah, just that if I can soliloquize a little bit on documentaries, there's a great article, which I'm going to link to in the show notes, about just how to view documentaries skeptically, because I do think that they are probably one of the most disingenuous mediums. And he links to a piece by Michael Moore, the most famous documentarian on the planet, and the most successful one as well. And Michael Moore is giving a list of advice to young documentarians. And the whole point is that the primary concern of a documentarian should be to be entertaining. So entertainment is the most important variable. It's not accuracy. It's not fidelity to the truth. It's not giving a fair and balanced account of what's going on. It's being entertaining. All else is secondary to that. So I just want to flag that, because I think that documentaries present themselves as being like an unfiltered view of the truth, when in fact they're one of the most manipulative forms of media.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. And it's also easy to keep in mind once you start doing a podcast like this and you realize if people were to take your words and arrange them in certain ways, they could really make you say anything. You know, if you just have people talking for long enough, there are ways in which to arrange whatever they're saying in order to have them expound like any sort of message that you want, really, especially if they're just dealing with that subject matter. And so they have those keywords in their vocabulary and they're just saying things about it. It is easy to manipulate things. So, yeah, this documentary and actually Michael Moore's recent documentary, his most recent one on the green energy movement, have both made me become more and more skeptical towards documentaries as a truth-telling form. Okay, so yeah, there's a couple threads, as you said, that we just need to disentangle, I think. And so obviously the first one that comes up, I think, in the documentary is just the reliance we have on the technology, right? And so putting aside what that reliance does or the echo chambers it creates, people are just lamenting the fact that teenagers in particular, but young adults in general, are spending a lot of time on these platforms and they're sucking up more and more of our time. People are spending a lot of their evenings, a lot of their weekends just like on their phone. And this is especially obvious during things like the pandemic. And so what I would say is, you know, reliance itself is not necessarily a problem.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's things about reliance, there's consequences of reliance that themselves can have negative consequences. But just spending time on something isn't necessarily a bad thing. And I think that was one of the first flags for me when I was watching the film, was just like the attitude that, like, obviously spending a lot of time looking at a screen is a bad thing. And, you know, you've referenced like the video game scare and the TV scare earlier. This reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Just like we have this intuition that like spending a long time doing one thing is automatically bad. Like watching a lot of TV has to be bad. Spending time playing violent video games, obviously going to increase violence among youth, right? And years later, we kind of realize like those were bogus claims. Research doesn't really carry it out. And so that was the first note to me that even though a lot of their later claims, I think, are valuable, just the fact that we're like worried about reliance and addiction in and of themselves is not necessarily a problem.
The word addiction is something that I've been really interested in recently, because I think people misunderstand that addiction isn't just repeated engagement in a behavior, but it's repeated engagement in a behavior which causes harm to yourself or other people. So the harm component is required to say something is addictive. And the way that I've like kind of conveyed this in the past is you can have people who are addicted to running, or at least let's say will run every day, will feel bad if they don't do it, and so basically can't really stop doing it, will feel physical signs of withdrawal, even withdrawal from running. But we wouldn't say it's an addiction because it is only benefiting themselves. And so reliance and repeated engagement in a particular behavior, or even a compulsion. So I would say that I'm compulsively listening to podcasts all day, every day, to the extent where, like, if I'm walking down the street and I don't have my headphones, I feel like physically uncomfortable because I know I could be like listening to something right now, right? There's like dopaminergic responses that I get when I'm like engaged in this behavior, but this isn't an addiction because it's just bettering myself, or so I hope. Just because people flip open their phone when they use the toilet does not mean this is necessarily a bad thing. And we need to go into the actual effects of this use. But I just want to flag that, because I think people tend to assume that because you have to do something, or because you do it ritualistically, or because you feel uncomfort when you stop doing it, therefore, it must be an addiction. It must be bad for you. And that's not true.
Yeah. So to draw an analogy with something that I think most people think pretty positively about, like meditation, right? So if you were to just like compulsively feel like you needed to like try and meditate a little bit every time you sat down on the toilet, or like when you're walking down the street, you need to think about your breath and whatnot, right? Like even if you felt compelled to do this, this is obviously, well, probably a pretty healthy behavior to engage in.
Yeah.
But so now I think we're going to diverge a little bit. So I'm going to claim that the reliance that is forming has negative effects. And so it's not the reliance in general that I am worried about, but it's like the effect of that reliance.
Yeah.
And so I think this comes sort of in two flavors. There's just like a mental health flavor that comes especially for young kids, like having a lot of your life displayed online and for others to evaluate by, you know, up clicks and down clicks, or, you know, whatever platform you're on. And then also how reliance influences where we're getting our information, who we're talking to, and its general relationship with like ideological echo chambers.
Totally.
And what I'm calling epistemological erosion.
Yeah.
So kind of like erodes the foundations of where we're getting our knowledge and how we're getting our knowledge and how we're thinking critically about the information we're getting. And so this first claim that it's like physiologically bad, psychologically bad, is obviously like an empirical claim and so my intuition is like, okay, obviously this is bad, right? If you have kids spending a lot of their time on Facebook, Snapchat, these kind of services, putting their entire life out there, Instagram, especially, I guess, following influencers that are cultivating an image, they look a certain way, and then you're only seeing like the highlights of people's lives, and so you are like more prone to depression and stuff. This was my intuition going into it, and so definitely not an unbiased intuition, but this is an empirical claim at the end of the day. And so there has been some studies done about this, like the effects of just social media engagement on people's lives. And admittedly, there's definitely not a broad consensus about the effects of social media, I would say. My reading is that people on average do think it's worse for you. So there's that big sort of meta analysis encapsulated by Google Doc that you pointed me towards that was put together.
Which we'll share.
Yeah, which we'll share. We'll put in the show notes. Put together by Jonathan Haidt and someone else whose name I'm blanking on. But so it seemed like the general, albeit slightly weak, consensus is that this is having harmful effects overall. So obviously we don't want to just turn this into a podcast where we're both like citing papers back and forth to each other. But I would just be interested to know if you to what extent you dove into the literature, and if you have a different reading of it than I do.
I dove in quite a bunch this last week or so. So before I talk about that, let's maybe just make a few high level comments. One is that like even talking about social media as one uniform thing, I think starts to muddy the conversation quite substantially, because there are a lot of like legitimate concerns about social media, which were raised by Tristan Harris et al. A while ago, which I think people have now taken on board and made corrections to. The snap streak was one, I think, particularly pernicious thing where it played on. So this is within Snapchat. If I send a Snapchat to you and you send one back to me, then we have a streak of two, as long as it's happened within 24 hours. And so you kind of play on this need to for reciprocity and stuff. But my main point is that I'm totally in favor of targeted criticisms of certain excesses and certain, let's say, bad design choices. And I think also a lot of the big tech companies are also in favor of improving this too. So that, like, the time well spent movement, which is Tristan Harris's brainchild, I think has really transformed a lot of what social media looks like these days. So when we go into the effects of social media on mental health, we should just keep in mind that it's not a single thing. Okay. So then zooming in a bit more in the documentary, the main focus was on the correlation between teenage girls' usage of social media and an increase in, I believe it was hospitalizations due to self-injury. So the reason Jonathan Haidt uses that metric is a quite objective way to measure mental health changes. And there has been a big spike, I think, starting in 2008, which is roughly when social media came around, with increase in the amount of teenage girls going to hospitals having self-harmed. So there is a real thing here. And now the question is, what is the cause of it? So my interpretation of the literature right now is that it's far from clear what the cause of this spike is. People have their various pet theories, but it's basically unclear. But one interesting thing that did come out of this, so despite all the unclarity, there was an interesting link at the very end of this giant Google Doc. The point was that most of the studies upon which this literature is based are using self-reports of social media use. So people are just asked, how often do you use social media each week? And that turns out to be incredibly not reliable. The way you can tell is because one set of researchers just gave people iPhones that had particular software on it that could track their actual usage and compare it to their self-reported usage. And so most of the studies which are being used to support the claim that social media is causing increase in teenage self-harm are based on this self-reporting thing. So that just is a big indication to me that we just have to put a big question mark here. It's too soon to say. But you mentioned COVID earlier, and I think that is really important to talk about when we talk about the effect of social media and mental health, because where would we be mental health-wise in this pandemic without the ability to communicate every day with our friends and family? I would feel fairly confident that my personal mental health would be diminished quite significantly. Of course, we can say you have emails, you have telephones and stuff, but there is just this fact that, like, there are many friends of mine, say, some friends in South Africa who I haven't talked to in, say, 10 years. But because we keep up to date roughly with one another's social media accounts, I would feel absolutely comfortable calling them and saying I'm in town and going for drinks and catching up. And so there's all these other effects of social media and social media's use on mental health, impact on mental health, which are just not even discussed at all. The ability to communicate instantaneously with everyone that is in your social circle, regardless of their immediate proximity, is a huge benefit to what's come before. And any conversation about the effect of social media on mental health has to include stuff like this. It can't just be reduced to teenage girls cutting themselves. That's a horrible problem. We need to fix that. But there is so much more to this phenomenon of instantaneous global communication and its effects on mental health, which is just completely neglected from this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, so when you bring up that last point, where would we be without instantaneous communication? I think there it's really important to start differentiating between the different types of social media, because it's not the platforms that are most talked about in this documentary, and I think are most worried about in terms of the effect of mental health, that are responsible for instantaneous communication. So for that, we have, you know, Skype, we have Zoom, we have FaceTime. But a lot of these do not face the same incentive structure that, for example, like your news feed on Facebook does, or that Instagram does, or that Twitter does, in terms of like incentivizing outrage, you know, stoking anger, stoking resentment. So, you know, you can differentiate among these platforms. And, you know, FaceTime is just an app on your phone that, you're right, is amazing and allows people, especially people who are now forced to be apart for long periods of time due to COVID, to be able to communicate. But so these are not necessarily the same platforms that we're talking about, right? Like you could separate these. You could have the instantaneous communication without Twitter.
Yeah, interesting. So I haven't thought about this before, but when I talk about instantaneous communication, I guess you fairly thought about FaceTime and Messenger. But then there's also this like passive, softer form of communication of just seeing people's day-to-day life photos. So I was referencing some friends in Cape Town, and I would have entirely lost touch with them had we not have some soft form of keeping in touch. And what I mean by that is likes and occasional comments. And it's a way to keep in touch with people. And formerly, people, like, I would have just lost touch entirely. I would never even have felt comfortable reaching out. And this all counts when we talk about the effect of social media on mental health.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, oh, so to be clear, like, I'm not saying you can divide every media platform into either being wholly positive or wholly negative.
Yeah, of course.
You know, there are, of course, positive reasons why we use Facebook. There's a reason it gained popularity in the first place. And that is underlined by precisely the point you're making, which is that it does help us keep in contact with those with whom we would have otherwise lost contact. And it does an incredible job at that. The question, or the problem rather, is that we have these benefits, but they're entangled with certain algorithmic decisions that instead of just allowing us to passively stay in contact with our friends and our family, are promoting things to the top of our newsfeed to keep us on Facebook as long as possible, instead of like going for a walk, for example, or listening to the next podcast. You know, they're incentivizing outrage. They're making us think the world is, you know, divided into black and white. And so in my mind, it's not a question of whether you have Facebook or don't have Facebook. It's whether the algorithmics driving Facebook's, for example, newsfeed need to be operationalized in the way they currently are, which I think are set up to incentivize the wrong kind of things and the wrong kind of time spent on Facebook. For most people, I think, and me included, the first things you see when you log into Facebook are the things that are most likely to grab your attention. And those for me, and I'm assuming a lot of other people, are like heated political debates and stuff, stupid stuff the other side said that your camp can jump on and be like, what a bunch of idiots. And, you know, it's only after actually searching up friends' names that I haven't seen in a while that I'm introduced to their pictures and able to catch up with them. And so it's not Facebook or no Facebook. It's a question of how Facebook's algorithmics are operationalized. Yeah.
Okay. So the main concern, I guess, is the effect of social media on political polarization and outrage.
So that would be one manifestation of the concern. But in general, like what? So here we're going to get into the consequences of just relying on reliance in general and trying to keep people for as long on your platform as possible, which is an inevitable consequence of the advertising route that something like Facebook has had. So it's a free service. And so how they get money is via advertisements. And advertisers come along and say, we want to target these kinds of people, right? And so Facebook is then incentivized to keep you on Facebook, looking at those advertisements for as long as possible. And another 10 seconds on Facebook makes them a lot of money. And so they're spending millions of dollars and paying some of the smartest people, some of the smartest engineers to just figure out how to keep you on Facebook for microseconds longer. And so, I mean, that's a whole another conversation about how we're using brain power.
Go ahead. Well, the advertisement model is, I think, really interesting, and it is given, I think, short shrift by Sam Harris and stuff. And like, let me just a side comment. Like, I love Sam Harris, but this seems to be his big weak spot. Like the AI and now social media. he just seems to be not nearly as skeptical of the claims that it's destroying the world as he should be. But so with the advertisement model thing, here's a conversation I had with some friends about this. When you go to a coffee shop and you buy a cup of coffee, what you're doing is you're exchanging your $3 for some coffee, and you value the coffee much more than you value the $3, and the barista values the $3 much more than they value the coffee. So there's an asymmetry of value here, which works out, it's mutually beneficial to both parties, and that's why people continue to do it, because they value things differently. with the advertisement model and privacy and free technology, there too is an asymmetry of value here, where I value, say, Google Maps and instantaneous communication much more than I value my browser history. And so I'm willing to trade it. It's implicit, and now it's becoming a bit more explicit with these kinds of conversations. But this I see as almost an innovation, and it has downsides, but it's an innovation in the sense that coming up with a new form of value asymmetry that people are able to agree with has produced technology which would not have been able to be produced any other way. Maps is a perfect example, but Facebook is as well. And so the advertisement model is only ever brought up in conversation when people talk about political ads and stuff, but it serves much more, a much higher function. The second function that it serves is providing useful signal into the market that you have a product which you're willing to pay to promote. So this is something that Mike Jordan brought up in one of his conversations with Lex Fridman, which is like, say if I have a new light bulb, and I think it's just the best light bulb in the world, and it actually solves some new problem, and I'm willing to pay, say, a couple thousand dollars to promote it, then you as a consumer, this is very valuable signal that of all the light bulbs out there, this one, the producer stands behind. Targeted advertisement allows this to happen at a lot of different scales. So unlike previously, where you had to basically pay like hundreds of millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars to get advertisements out, now you can be a local hobbyist and you want to promote your new, say, wood sculptures. And now you can spend a small amount of money to promote this. Again, when people talk about ads, they think go right to Cambridge Analytica, and they go right to just we're all brainwashed, stupefied zombies. But the ad model is just as much as in support of small business owners and hobbyists as it is these political lobby groups. And again, all of this is completely neglected from the conversation when the whole point is just to terrify people about the effects of social media.
I don't think consumers necessarily understand the value of the information they're giving away. So for example, in the coffee shop example, you know what the coffee is going to taste like. You know, you've had it before, presumably, and you know you want to spend $3 on it. And you know that $3 are just like going in to the cashier in front of you. And so you're in that transaction, you're sort of aware of both parties and what's happening on the other side of that transaction. But when you're not paying for social media, and we weren't doing this, you know, 2004 to 2015, so when we were sort of largely ignorant of like some of these forces and some of the outcomes, I don't think we realized the extent to which the advertising model forces companies to try and keep you on their platforms at all costs. And so I'm not targeting necessarily the advertisers. I'm targeting the effects of a system which requires to try and keep you on the platform as much as possible in order for them to get paid by the advertisers. So regardless of how harmless the actual advertisements are, Facebook is incentivized now to keep you on the platform as long as possible. So you see those advertisements, and that incentive manifests itself in certain forms, namely by hijacking our desire for outrage.
Interesting. So again, using incentivized to keep you on the platform as a harm in and of itself is a circularity in the
argument. It's the stoking outrage.
Just being incentive.
It's the consequence.
Okay, so yeah, okay, so we haven't got to. Yeah. Okay, so we need to go to the outrage bit in a sec. So yeah. Okay, good point. The information thing is like, I don't think super accurate, because I don't know what the barista is going to use the $3 for. If they're going to use it to, say, pour money into my least favorite political organization, then I wouldn't want to give them money for the coffee, right? Mm. So there's imperfect information everywhere you go. Right. All we can do is work with the local information we have, and over time see if the repetition of these local exchanges produces something that everyone benefits from in the aggregate. And I would argue that in both cases, this is true. On the outrage thing, so the first observation is that the implied and unstated assumption is that polarization was better before social media, and now it's worse. I view it differently, which is that we had before social media, all these echo chambers and bubbles. And there was just no or very little interaction between these bubbles. So if you spoke to your people in your church, you're going to be in a bubble. And if I spoke to people in my community, I'm going to be in a bubble too. The consequence of having a bunch of bubbles interact is that you're going to have a bunch of angry arguments where the two bubbles start touching, right? Mm. And so it could just as much be said, and I think it's actually more plausible, that social media is doing a better job of bringing bubbles into contact. Mm. Where on Twitter, you have a whole bunch of echo chambers and a whole bunch of bubbles, which previously would have just been not in contact with one another. And then when you start bringing these bubbles into contact, then you start getting a bunch of fighting. And this is fighting, which is a natural consequence of two different worldviews having to reconcile one another's arguments. And so the view here would be that Twitter and Facebook and social media in general is not causing echo chambers or causing political polarization. It is bringing echo chambers which have already existed together. And when this happens at scale, you're going to have more fighting and more arguments being made. But this is what happens when you reduce echo chambers, right? And so that would be my view before we go into the nitty-gritty. And I can point to some studies and stuff, but as you said, pointing to studies after studies is boring. But I'll put in the show notes one study in particular I thought was kind of interesting, which is studying the bubbles on Twitter in particular. And they made the comment that you have 1% of users engaging in most of the, disputes on Twitter.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, though, is that for the 99% of people, the stuff that they post tends to be moderated compared to what they receive. So, and I know this rings very true in my own life, where I have certain information streams, which I know are anti-orthodox. And the stuff that I post on social media tends to be the most moderate, most center variant of it. And so given that you have an audience of people in your network that you know exist in other bubbles, you are incentivized to actually moderate the stuff you post, not intensify it. This seems very intuitively plausible because I know I experience this every time I post something slightly controversial.
Nice. Okay, there was a couple things there. I'm definitely going to forget everything as I try and talk through it, so I'll just have to come back to it when I remember. But one thing I want to point out is it's not necessarily the claim that polarization was lower previously and higher now, and therefore that's the effect of social media. You're looking at the counterfactual of like social media versus no social media. So there could be confounding factors, for example, that make polarization lower overall or something. And it's just a question of like, what is the effect on social media? And so not all of the rise or all of the decrease in polarization is necessarily the cause of social media. Right. So it's just a question of like, to what extent is social media influencing polarization? Because presumably there are many other confounding factors. The other thing is that, so it's not necessarily, so when we're talking about, how is social media influencing political conversation and our ability to communicate and problem solve? I don't think it's a good enough argument to say social media is bringing echo chambers into contact with one another, and therefore it might be valuable. I think the argument is like, what would another form of social media look like? What would a better form of social media look like? So I'm not necessarily interested in the counterfactual of like, take 2020 as it is right now, and try and picture 2020 if Facebook hadn't been invented in 2004. And now how does our political discourse look? It's rather, given how Facebook and these other companies have materialized, let's try and analyze their effect on political discourse and talk about whether this is going in a positive direction and whether it should be changed. So do we think that the way that these echo chambers are coming into contact with one another is being done in a healthy way? Or should we be looking at how to change these platforms such that the political interaction that they're encouraging, that they're inevitably encouraging for sure, because their whole point is facilitating communication between a bunch of different people. Could this be done in a healthier, positive way? Do we like the trends that we're seeing? Is the collision of these echo chambers good? Is it resulting in healthy dialogue that's actually leading us to be able to solve problems more effectively and make alliances across the political spectrum? Or is it just creating boogeymen and people who are siloed ever more into their original echo chamber and whatnot?
Totally. Yeah. So if the question is like what improvements could be made to social media to improve dialogue, 100% excellent questions. I'm totally in favor of these considerations. Yes. If the question is social media the cause of political polarization? As I think the documentary explicitly implies, or as in fact, Sam Harris says with,
he says it's basically the cause of everything else, right? Yeah.
The cause. And so I want to push you a little bit because it's even implied in your phrase of epistemic erosion, or how did you phrase it?
I like that. Yeah, epistemological erosion.
Yeah, excuse me, epistemological erosion. So when Sam talks about the, what's the phrase he uses? Shattering of epistemologies, I think, or epistemological erosion, there is like this implication that there used to be a time when epistemologies were not eroded, and now erosion is taking place. There used to be a time when everyone agreed on truth, and now truth is fragmented. There used to be a time when everyone could speak harmoniously, and this all has been eroded by social media, right? In my notes leading to this conversation, I just had in big, bold letters, truth is not manifest. Truth is not obvious. There never was a time when everyone could agree on what the truth is. There's this like idea that social media is now making it harder for us to find out what's true. And I'm like, are you fucking crazy? We've never had an easy time figuring out what is true. And like one way I think you can see this is if you think of like the terminal point of a pure breakdown in truth, I think is just war, where you have, say, one group saying that Muhammad is God and the other group saying that Jesus is God. And they both are making truth claims. And so I would think that it's reasonable to say that when you have truth breaking down entirely, you get war. So we can use the amount of war as a proxy for the amount of breakdown in truth. And you've read Pinker, you know basically the arguments. But like, if we go back in time, like right before social media, 2008, we had the Iraq War and the war in Afghanistan, which I would not say was a time of epistemological unity. Go back further, we have the Cold War, where you have the absolute truth in communism versus the absolute truth in anti-communism. Further than that, you have the religious wars destroying Europe for 500-600 years. And so, like, when we talk in terms of shattering and talk in terms of erosion, we are making this claim that it's much worse today than it used to be. And I think this is not true. And so I guess this is me poking at your phrase here and seeing how much you believe the implications of the word erosion.
No, I don't. Again, I think you're just picking out the wrong counterfactual, right? I don't think it has anything to do with like where we were in the past. And I think, by the way, your implication, it's not a like, the analogy with war, it's not a necessary and sufficient condition. So the breakdown of truth might lead to war, but war is not necessarily the result of a breakdown of truth.
Yeah, excellent. So, yeah, good point. Yeah.
Anyway, so you can't,
Yeah.
So the trend analysis doesn't follow there. But so so the erosion, so your question, I guess, is like, what the hell are you comparing it to, right? It's not like in the past everyone was holding hands and dancing around the tree of truth and we could all agree on like exactly what a fact was and how big Donald Trump's inauguration ceremony was. It was also chaos. It was chaos, right? So the question is social media helping? Is it helping us in this venture to try and create public conversation that is allowing us to solve our problems?
Ooh, may I jump in? So, I think that it's not, is social media helping? Has social media made it worse? And then you can flip the question. You can say, well, what changes can we make to social media in order for it to help? But the original goal of social media was never to tackle this problem because it is, I think, a very challenging one. The goal is just to connect people.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, no, I don't think technologies are invented to tackle like a specific goal of promoting truth, but they've become so ubiquitous that we have to ask the question, is this helping our public dialogue or not? Is this helping our political discourse or not? And whether they like it or not, this has become some of their, these are some of the most important questions to ask. And this is some of the responsibility that these big tech companies now have to shoulder, right? Because so much of the public conversation is being aided, for better or for worse, by their platforms. It doesn't seem relevant whether they were created to handle this problem or not. They are either helping it or hindering it, or it's neutral. We're just trying to analyze that facet of their performance. But okay, so the question is it helping? And this is where it's kind of unfortunate that I'm like not on Twitter or like Instagram or where these fucking conversations are being had. So I'm like super biased from the get-go. But all I can say is like, dude, when I log on to Twitter, like sometimes I'll just, you know, there's a journalist that I like. And I'll be kind of curious what they're up to. You know, I'll jump on Steven Pinker's Twitter or Jonathan Haidt's or something. And it's fucking chaos, dude. I spend 50 minutes on Twitter and then Mira will like look over at my screen and be like, what the hell are you doing? And just see a little tear coming down my eye and my mouth aghast and just be like, you know, why are you putting yourselves through psychological torment? And I gotta say, it's fucking stressful. And, you know, maybe I just don't have the cojones for Twitter or something. But in general, I just think this medium, so in Twitter's case, you know, this medium of like 140, or I guess it's increased now to like 280 or whatever, where you have to give, you know, tiny little paragraph or sentence versions of what should be very nuanced ideas discussed presumably in some long form public space. And you have to, you know, put them out there in this fucking battleground, battling against another 280 characters. It just does not seem like healthy discourse. I've rarely logged on to see very nuanced conversation. And of course, this is not to say that you can't find pockets of Twitter where people are having like robust dialogue and some people are not engaged in the ultimate food fight that, you know, is going on in 99% of the Twitter sphere. But it just does not seem healthy. And then, you know, from my personal experience, just logging onto Facebook, whatever's promoted at the top, and just people's, the general tone and quality of political discourse on Facebook, quite frankly, is terrible. So maybe I'm just, you know, have the wrong friends or something, but it just is not a reliable source of information. And, you know, I come across people who are like, otherwise very intelligent, well-intentioned people spouting off stuff that's just like obviously false, that they haven't verified themselves. And this scares the shit out of me. And so the availability, you know, we're all prone to availability bias and confirmation bias. And so the tendency to see a story that opposes some viewpoint of yours, and to like actually deal with its arguments and critically analyze the piece instead of just, you know, logging onto Twitter and seeing who from your team has destroyed the argument. Mm-hmm. I see most people going down that path and just like virtue signaling their way to victory. So I don't know if you have a different experience on these platforms than I do, if you're actually learning a lot of stuff all the time. You could just be a more enlightened human being. Actually, we know you are a more enlightened
human being. So I think at one point Popper talks about how one of the biggest innovations in humanity is replacing a war of swords with a war of words, right? Clever wordplay, which is why I like to quote, drop the S. But you keep dismissing might sound a little harsher than I intend, but when I talk about compared to what, I compare it to what has come before. And when you talk about compared to what, you compare it to counterfactuals, which have never existed, like some thing which it could be, right? And both obviously are useful because the compared to what, from your perspective, is a way to find ways that we can improve the platform, right? So the compared to what is like compared to some better thing, which I'm going to come up with and let's try to get there. But my perspective is also important because we have to look at the history of things as they have been made.
Right.
I see a lot of the social media debates replacing violence.
But where, like when, like what period of history are you talking about?
So I'm talking about this period of history. I'm talking about, for example, the like Ben Shapiro destroys videos, right? And how people get on to these rabbit holes of watching people get destroyed. Mm-hmm. What are they watching people get destroyed by? Arguments, right? So it's still playing to the baser nature of human beings. You want to see your enemy crushed, but you want to see your enemy crushed by debate points. This is a huge improvement to watching people get crushed in, say, a UFC arena. When you see like Ben Shapiro destroys or what have you, I contrast that to just actually celebrating violence. And you contrast it to civil debates over podcasts like you and I are trying to have right now. Right. but like we have to bear in mind that most like the way that you and I communicate is fucking hard. Like it's hard to really take time teasing out the other person's argument, trying to put the other person's argument at the strongest possible version, calling bullshit when it's said. But like this takes goddamn skill and it is a constant struggle. And I'm not patting ourselves on the back. I'm saying that it's something I'm constantly working at. It takes 24-hour attention to continue to try to improve the way that I debate and communicate with others. Most people don't have this time and attention. And when you look at Twitter, you look at just the entire world doing this at once, right? And then you contrast it to the EA communities where everyone is like Mauricio and is just the most kind, lovely person on the planet. And they all just like gently want to write 50-page essays to one another in order to communicate. And like, that would be great if everyone was like the EA community and like Mauricio. But in most cases, we're replacing people who are just getting into this game, right? And so we're seeing people who are learning about argumentation from every level, from the pinkers to seasoned vets down to the 17-year-old who realizes how fun it is to watch his opponent get destroyed. And that's great. Like I remember when I was 21, I just watched endless Hitchens videos and I just loved watching him destroy his opponents in debates. But this was my kind of youthful self realizing how powerful ideas were. And realizing how like the ability to communicate is one of the most important things that one can cultivate in oneself. And now I don't watch people getting destroyed as much as I just watch long form lectures. But we have to recognize that this is, what you're seeing at Twitter on Twitter is everyone doing this at the same time. And what they're doing is debating. And that is a good thing, compared to, something else. But then that isn't to say that we can't improve it. And that's where a lot of what you're saying makes perfect sense. And we need to continue to work towards improving it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Two points. So one is just a clarification. So, okay. So you're saying YouTube, for example, in the case that you cited is, you know, allowing us to start engaging with like arguments and ideas and stuff in sort of like this tribalistic way, at least at first, that sort of appeals to our confrontational nature, say, and then maybe hopefully this sort of like evolves over time into more sophisticated nuanced conversation. Wouldn't this imply that if this were the case that so say like the 20, 30 years before YouTube in this case, that we should have seen these confrontations take place like with violence? Like sort of, so the period, like not like 1800s, not even early 1900s, but 1970 to when it, 2005,
like during the Vietnam, right? During the Vietnam era, for example.
Right. But I'm talking like locally, like local politics, say, shouldn't we have seen these sort of tensions resolved in like fist fights and stuff?
Yeah. And I think that has been borne out in many cases. So, like the spike in homicide and violence and stuff, which is documented both by Pinker, but just inner city violence and gangs and things in the US, I think was much higher 70s, 80s, 90s. And that's one of the things which led to the war on drugs, right? And the punitive mass incarceration policies. So it absolutely implies this. Yes, totally. And I think that's all documented in detail in Pinker's book.
But the effect that the positive effect that social media has on crime, this is just like a new claim that I didn't.
Not that social media has on crime. No, I think it's too soon to say, but you said, doesn't it imply that in like the 70s and 80s, there would be more violence? All I can say is that there was more violence in the past. And the claim that social media is increasing polarization and stuff, would itself imply that you'd have more violence today than, back then. And so I don't want to go too strong with the claim, just that I think that everyone going online and debating is messy and is awkward as it is better than everyone not going online and debating.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, if there is a causal link there between decrease in violence and increased use of social media, then.
Well, okay. So there's definitely a causal claim between decrease in violence and increased use of words, of talking and of argument and discussion and debate. That is born out from the Enlightenment on, right?
But at a broad scale, right? Like Pinker talked about this at the scale of war, not at the scale of like inner city crime, for example.
No, Pinker does scale of war right down to spanking, right? So he goes from the very large global right down to the, like right through inner cities down to interpersonal violence when it comes to parenting styles and stuff. And at every level you see big decreases. But let's not get too much into the weeds there. My only point is that in general, replacing swords with words is an improvement. And let's not forget that we're replacing swords with words. And so the words that are going to be used are going to be pretty uncivil. And this speaks to the larger thesis, which is that if social media is bringing different echo chambers into close contact, right, then you are absolutely going to see some pretty bloodthirsty and pretty nasty debates being had. But this is much better than when the echo chambers weren't in contact at all.
Yeah, okay. I guess so. That brings us to another point, which is how much better is it? So yes, it creates conversation between different groups, but I don't think groups are dealing with the best version of their opponent's arguments or are very likely to change their minds. And so if it's a question between staying in your sort of close-knit community with people who largely agree with you versus like engaging with social media and just strawmanning your opponents and thinking that the rest of the country is an idiot for taking some side of a question that you disagree with, I'm not sure which one of those is better.
Let me fill up my drink. So you had asked me whether or not it's better that people are online strawmanning each other's views and arguing very poorly compared to them just not arguing at all.
Yeah, I guess compared to the older status quo of just like less political involvement, less political identity, like being less engaged with their political identities.
Yeah, I think that it absolutely is better that everyone's arguing badly compared to not arguing at all. Like
as a true Popperian,
Well, it's like the whole point of like an infinite regress of criticism is that most of the criticism is going to be pretty bad. But at least you have people coming up with arguments, right? And the alternative is fewer arguments. So like if the question is, would you prefer if people argued perfectly or not at all, to take it right to the extreme? Yeah, like it would be great if everyone's going to argue perfectly, but no one is. That's impossible. And so you're going to have strawmans, you're going to have ad hominems, you're going to have all of the various things which we are just accustomed to. But it's better than not arguing at all. It's better than not talking to one another. Twitter, like to go back to the original subject of Twitter, it can be pretty brutal out there. Yeah, for sure. But we have to keep in mind that it's only about 1% of Twitter users who are doing most of the engagement, and the vast majority are just passive observers.
Or they've just left Twitter. I don't know if they're observing or if they've just fucking gone. Okay, yeah, I mean, I want to bring up one more point on this front, which is that I don't think it's, the binary is not between everyone arguing perfectly or not at all. The question is having general members of the public just be slightly more apolitical or less, or having less of their identity completely intertwined with their political leanings. So, for example, 50s, 60s, 70s, less political polarization in the U.S. I'll take the U.S. because I know it's political history somehow better than I know Canada's. just because I've been obsessed for a little while now. But people's political identities were more cross-cutting. So they like touched on various aspects of like their interests and whatnot. You know, senators, congressmen in the U.S. were less politically polarized. And just in general, the political landscape was less polarized, and people would like you'd have to form coalitions with people from the other party to actually get shit done, right? And so, and in this landscape where things are like increasingly more polarized, there's like more and more gridlock at the congressional level, for example, and there's just like less shit gets done because everyone's just towing the party line. And so, I don't think it's a choice between having like no conversation or bad conversation. It's a choice between having people. A lot of the members of public just less invested in, for example, political outcomes at the federal level, and more just interested in things at their local level that like affects their communities and stuff. And communities largely share or they share more politics than and are less polarized than they are at the federal level. And largely because they know each other and can actually have conversations and see that their political enemies, quote unquote, is like the person living across the street. And so they tend to have stuff in common with them. And so it's a question of like what kind of conversations are being had and how healthy those conversations are and what sort of political consequences they are leading to. And not necessarily a question of just like no conversation or all conversation.
Yeah, like I guess I just think it's not really our place to say what other people should be talking about in general. And it would be great if people talked only about Popper. That would be awesome. but like it's not up to anyone to decide what the conversation is going to be. And if people are right now more interested in federal politics because of some people who shall remain unnamed, then that is the case. But I guess 9 months ago, I wouldn't have expected people to be as interested in, say, biology and pandemics and viruses as they are now. But when things happen, then people's attention will gravitate to that. Privileging local politics over federal politics is nice, but like if everyone takes a side on local politics, you're going to have just as much animosity.
I think that's wrong. I think like the online environment leads to more animosity than it does at the local level, because locally you're disagreeing with people you see in person who share friends with you who are in similar circles.
There's two things being conflated. There's local and federal, and then there's online and not online.
Yeah.
So you mean offline local.
Yeah. So I mean, my general claim is that and in the U.S. For example, Ezra Klein makes this point in his recently pretty mediocre book, honestly, but it's got a couple good points in it. And that's that this online discussion, which tribalizes politics and inflames identities, inevitably sort of raises things to the federal level, or rather not inevitably, but that's what's happened. It's a nice binary system for people to sort their identities into. And so social media has made it easy for these two groups to sort. And this has happened at the federal level. Whereas when people were more invested in local politics, a lot more shit got done, because people's identities are like much less ingrained with like specific policy decisions at the local level.
I just returned to like the narcissism of small differences thing, right? Where people tend to hate those who are most similar to themselves. And local, federal, it's kind of arbitrary, and like hate is going to hate. People are going to find reasons to.
Right. So the question is like, how do we reduce that? Like what environments encourage the best political conversations happen, right? And I'm saying it's not these online environments, because they encourage polarization.
I mean, Rwanda didn't have too many Facebook posts, but there was a hell of a lot of polarization.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying social media is the only thing that can lead to polarization.
Yes, but I guess you are kind of saying that like local politics could be better than global politics or geopolitics or federal politics. Because when you're local and you're close and you're face to face and you can actually discuss things in person, then you're going to have civility. You're not going to have machetes or roadside bombs like you do in many civil wars. Like, what's the civil war if not local politics gone wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just claiming that social media does a better job at weaponizing your political identity than does just like local political coalitions when you actually have to talk to people face to face. Like, you know, there's a reason Myanmar had a genocide against the Rohingya Muslim minority there. This is another point that's brought up in the documentary, I guess, that we didn't touch on. And so I'm not sure what your take on that is, but we see international consequences of intense propaganda and polarization that is a result of some of these social media platforms.
Yeah, so I'm reading this really interesting book right now, which unfortunately I'm not done, so I can't fully summarize, but it's called Not Born Yesterday, and the whole thesis is that human beings aren't nearly as gullible as we all like to think we are. So there's this like common idea that like the public is just this like huddling mass of stupefied idiots who are able to be propagandized and turned against one another. And the Rohingyan Muslim conflict is not due to deep-seated ethno-national tension and stuff. It's due to social media. And if we didn't have social media there, then we wouldn't have had the genocide. But it's exactly backwards. Like social media in the vast majority of cases are just a platform for human beings to do what human beings do. Tristan Harris raises some excellent points about how it's not nearly as neutral as people initially thought, but I think it's gone way too far where people go from thinking it's perfectly neutral to thinking that, it's like half neutral, to thinking it's the cause of everything. And like the Rohingya genocide, I would be willing to bet would happen with or without Facebook. I don't know enough of the details. If you want to push that point, then I'll just concede. But,
really?
But like there aren't enough genocides that have happened without social media to make me think that it's not really a social media problem. yeah. Like I recognize that some aspects of social media will inflame existing tensions and that we can make reasonable changes to reduce this. But like the implication that most of this wouldn't have happened had social media not been there, or social media is making everything worse. I just think about the fact that the United States had a president assassinated, it had a civil war, it had participated in two world wars. Like, this is polarization. This is polarization at every level. And to think that we can just blame social media for all of the various infighting we see seems to me to be ahistorical, I guess.
Yeah, I guess there's just, I feel like we're coming at it from slightly different angles. I think I'm arguing about like what I would like to see out of it, what incentives I would like. I'm arguing, yeah, from a place of absence rather than a place of history. Like I certainly take Pinker's arguments on board. And I generally think the present, while it has a lot of problems, is gotten a lot of things right. And we've, you know, progressed in many, many dimensions.
Oh, so here's a question directly for you. So, part of Pinker's argument is that there's always apocalyptic prophets and Yukowski saying that like the world's going to be destroyed in 20 years and that we're like this close to an apocalypse and global ecological collapse and this, that, and the other. And this people always say this. And so when I went back to the social dilemma, it was so clear to me that this is just what is going on. But you seem to differ. And so I guess my question is, what do you use to tell if it's just yet another apocalyptic prediction that needs to be basically put into the same category as fear about video games or rap music or what have you, or if this one's legit?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's not a binary choice between it being like an existential threat and a sign of progress. It's not either of those, right? It's somewhere in the middle. There's a place to stand when you are criticizing technology that comes from a place of, yes, this technology is perhaps better than what we've seen in the past and yet needs significant improvements to get to a better place. And I think that's where I'm standing, right? It's a place of maybe this is better than the counterfactual of having not invented social media in the first place. I don't know. That's a hard counterfactual to evaluate. But I do think that there are lots of problems with how social media is operated, what sort of political discourse especially is being generated by social media, what sort of memes get picked up. You know, I see like public hysteria about certain elements and no hysteria about other elements, right? I see like certain videos or whatnot, you know, certain articles, whatever, like going viral and picking up so many hits. And then I see tragedies like the Uyghur Muslim camps in China that are basically ignored by everyone in the US, right? Like no one's fucking paying attention to this. And this is a crime against humanity that's like, you know, going on. And we're concerned about like TikTok being banned or something. And so that's not to say, oh, in the past, of course, we probably wouldn't have even been aware of the concentration camps in China. But that's not to excuse our behavior now and to say that, oh, all political discourse is as it should be. And then at a more personal level, I just see a lot of friends who just lose their minds when it comes to social media and let their brains like saute in a frying pan when it comes to a lot of these facts. And I, you know, it's just crazy, right? Like anything that aligns with their pre-existing biases, whether it's Bill Gates donating to campaigns or, you know, what have you, just like, if you don't like Bill Gates, all of a sudden you believe everything written about Bill Gates, no matter how disreputable the source. And this like really scares me. And because the problem is you can, if you spend enough time on Twitter, you can find as much outrage as you want. There's no end to it, right? It's not like reading a newspaper where you flip the last page and that's it. And people had to write long columns and there's only so much attention of yours it can grab. It's like, there's infinitely many attention grabbing items on Facebook, on Twitter. And I do think that's a problem for like the psychological sanity of our society.
If you only have two or three books to read, there's no guarantee that you're going to be less outraged, I think, than like if you have one. Let's go right back to the first book, the Bible. You did not have peace when you had a single book. And so the concern that you raise about your people around you going like losing their minds, I suspect that every generation has felt this. And actually, oh no, I have a data point. I have a single data point for this thesis. So I just watched this movie, which I absolutely love. It's called Dinner with Andre. And it's just this 2-hour conversation in real time at a restaurant. So they go, the movie starts, they order their meal, 45 minutes goes by, they're talking and the meal comes and then 45 minutes goes by and the movie ends and they pay their bill and they leave. Nice. But it was made in the 1981, and close to the end of it, Andre, one of the two conversation partners, talks about how he has a friend who like he just has to step away from magazines and television and newspapers because it's just making him crazy. Like he's felt so much better once he just turned off all of the politics of the magazines and the newspapers and the television.
Yeah.
Like knowing that we would be talking about this today, it was like, oh, that stood out because people have felt like this for a while. And I wasn't even looking for it. It just happened to be like a conversation point in this movie in the '80s. And I just imagine that 28-year-olds of every generation are going to feel like, oh my God, it's never been this bad. And look to their local information source as the cause of this.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm saying it's never been this bad. I'm just pointing out the myriad of problems that exist with the current technology. And I'm just, in terms of the data point of like conspiracy theories, I'm not sure, I don't actually know, but I would imagine the rate of conspiracy thinking is exceptionally high right now. I mean, we've got like the fucking QAnon cult just like entrapping many people with like, I don't know.
I did like a tiny little data science thing on this to answer this question. Obviously you can't answer it fully, but I just took all of the, like the creation of cults. There's a Wikipedia page on when like the list of cults in the US.
Yeah.
And just plotted the number of cults per decade that were around. Big spike in the '70s. And then kind of peters out.
Interesting, yeah.
Take this with a grain of salt, obviously.
Because it doesn't take into account subscription rates, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah. So that's the biggest one. But I just would have expected to see some spike in the 2000s. Like, QAnon is a huge one, but even if you have one massive cult, you would expect there to be a lot of like little cults. And I didn't see it. And like when Sam Harris titles his podcast, like the Cult Factory or whatever the hell he titled it, like a Welcome to the Cult Machine or some just very like extreme thing, and I'm like, Sam, you're just, this is ridiculous. Like, you're not even asking for data, you're not even like looking for information for this. It's just numbers here. And
we'll have him on and criticize.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we should wind up, man, because it's been a while. And
I think you made a really valuable point that I want to highlight. And so for people who are coming at it with sort of my biases, I think it is really important to think about social media and its effects in a historical context. And I'm still not completely convinced about its causal role in decreasing violence of various sorts, but I think that's an argument worth taking seriously. And two, even just the correlation there is probably worth thinking about. And just the general heuristic of thinking about social media, not as a phenomenon just of the last 15 years, but thinking of it as the newest phenomenon in a series of attempts to have humans just converse with one another in slightly more productive ways goes a long way, I think, towards reasoning a little more fully about the picture we're in right now. So that was, I don't know if you didn't fully change my mind. I think I'm still more skeptical about its effects than you are, and pretty worried about its effect on our political discourse in particular. But I think that heuristic of just putting it in historical context is very useful.
I hadn't thought about that from this perspective, but just to kind of conclude, like, we're undergoing a mass experiment where the entire world is able to talk to each other at once. Right.
Yeah.
Simultaneously. And like, what do we expect it's going to look like? Do we think it's going to be harmonious? I would expect to see a lot of the stuff that we've described today.
Yeah.
And so I take many of your points about how like we can continue to, and we need to continue to work towards improving the quality of the dialogue and the discourse, and that social media has many problems when it comes to, say, exacerbating some of these more base tendencies. But I think, one, the whole world talking to each other is better than the whole world not talking to each other. And yeah. Two, I'm very skeptical of many of the strong claims in the documentary that social media is the thing to blame. And I think that viewers should see the documentary and also other documentaries made about new technology, anti-GMO, anti-nuclear power, anti-video games, anti-rap music, yeah. Like, there's just so many of these, and I just see it as the next incarnation of this. And so these are my main thoughts.
It just struck me that the claim that social media is the root of all problems is sort of similar to Marx's opening line in his manifesto, in the Communist Manifesto, where he says, like, all of history has been a class war or war of class. I forget how he frames it, but it's just this assertion that, like, reality is this battle between class A and class B, or the effects of social media, and, you know, this is the dominant problem of our time. And, you know, problems are, they're not multifaceted and complex and have pros and cons, but one thing is to blame for everything, and as soon as we solve this problem, we will live in a utopia. So that's definitely a bit of a steel man of that position, but the general rhetoric does remind me of that. Like, this is the problem of our time. You know, this is what defines our age. It's AI, unalignment, and social media.
And it's so interesting how many of these arguments can be basically just lifted and placed onto the same discussions about first past the post, first proportional representation. That, like, first past the post is the thing causing polarization, and then you just off to the races and stuff. And so everyone has their favorite pet theory about why polarization is this bad, and it's never been this bad, etc. And the last thing I'll say is that, viewers, please, or listeners, please, all documentaries that have a political agenda, just recognize that, like, the main intention of the filmmaker is to be entertaining and not to be close to truth.
I don't know, man. That extreme center content in that documentary was pretty, pretty wild.
Okay, well, can I say? So I didn't say this in the talk in our conversation today, but, like, this drove me so fucking crazy. It's what a vent now that we're winding down. So here's my vent. So Tristan Harris, one of his primary pillars of his argument is that social media causes conspiracy theories. And then in the documentary, he literally has three people conspiring the entire time. It's like these three evil scientists are conspiring to turn this boy into, like, some shell of a human being. And then they, like, congratulate themselves after they, like, hollowed him out of any form of individuality. And then the camera zooms out and he's, like, just one of many groups of these evil conspiring scientists in this, like, Matrix hellscape dystopia. And we're all just, I'm like, you have the fucking audacity to talk about conspiracy theories, and then you just weave a conspiracy theory through your entire documentary. Like, it's just insulting to the audience. And so, sorry, that was my vent. That's obviously not
that's fair. I guess one thing we didn't talk about was, like, the asymmetry of power there. I think he's got a good point, right? It's not just you against one other, you know. Anyway, there is a bunch of engineers that you're fighting against to keep your attention. But
he talks about, now I want to go down this rabbit hole. We'll edit this out, put it at the end, or what have you. But he talks about, like, how you have, like, a supercomputer pointed at your brain, and it's like you versus the supercomputer. And so first, supercomputers are just big, stupid things. Like, they're not any smarter than a small computer. There's just more of them, so you can process more data. And supercomputers are not any smarter than a human brain. So when you and I are having a conversation, I could say that it's like a brain pointed at another brain. But this is just, like, a very extreme way to communicate. But most importantly, the main work that these, like, computers are doing is just handling scale. So they're just having to deal with huge numbers of people all communicating with one another. This is no scarier than a bunch of advertising executives in Mad Men coming up with the most possible persuasive advertisement. It's just people trying to be persuasive. So I don't think that there's a deep asymmetry here. I think most of the work is just about handling scale and network trafficking and stuff.
I think he's getting to, like, the predictive elements of the algorithms, right? So there's, like, and of course, when he's talking about a supercomputer pointed at your brain, he's talking about, like, statistically, on average, these algorithms, just because of the massive amount of data they're mining, have been able to predict your interests based on the general population much better than I can predict your interests. So if I'm trying to feed you, if I'm trying to serve you up a news feed of like things I think you're going to be interested in, a computer, Facebook's algorithm is going to do it much better than I am, right?
But it's not predicting your interests or my interests. It's predicting, on average, the interests of their user, right?
Yeah, which but get it's, more it's accurate as if, like, over time with more users and more data, right? Yeah.
But it's not as if they, like, you could go to somebody and say, okay, predict what Ben's going to be interested in for the next 3-4 years.
It's about the next click, like the next data point. Yeah,
it's like I can predict that if you buy toothpaste, you're going to buy a toothbrush as well, and then I'm going to recommend that product. If you click on article from Fox News, you're probably going to like an article from The Spectator. And okay, so what?
Yeah, I mean, understanding the complexities or lack thereof of the algorithms involved doesn't undermine his point, right? Which is just that YouTube's recommendation algorithm, for example, is extremely powerful. Because it can, based on just basically massive correlations and some form of logistic regression, predict what people are going to be interested in and on average. And so, yeah, it's not a determining factor of human values or interests, or it doesn't determine our future to 100% accuracy.
But all of this only matters if it causes harm, right? And if it doesn't cause harm, then it doesn't matter if they can predict stuff. It doesn't matter if they can keep us on the platform. It only matters if it causes harm.
Right. And but I think we've seen that YouTube's prediction algorithm, for example, has caused a lot of harm.
Have we? Like with the conspiracy theory stuff?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I don't know, man. Like, we can point to Alex Jones. We can point to QAnon and all this, but we can also point to people who have been de-radicalized through YouTube recommendations. No one talks about that.
Yeah, it's a matter of numbers.
Absolutely haven't.
Like, how many more people are pushed towards extreme content than are shown some nuanced argument? And I think...
And have you seen these numbers? Because I have not seen arguments that have shown that, like, YouTube recommendations has increased the number of cults or conspiracy.
No, I mean, I don't think the data is public, but presumably, I mean, this is where you take on good faith that these people are, like, actually telling the truth, right? But when they say the YouTube algorithms have extremized and are lead to a tendency to, like, push people in radical directions, I take that on board as probably pretty good evidence that they are doing that.
It's not that I take it on bad faith or that I think that they're lying. I think that they aren't looking at the larger picture, because there's as many YouTube recommendations which recommend Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris videos as there are which recommend Islamic fundamentalist videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would suspect that, like, the majority of Sam's user base has been propelled by YouTube recommendations of people who watch Richard Dawkins, and then they recommend Sam Harris. And how much has he done to de-radicalize and decultify the world? A lot. But it's not that I think that they're lying. I just don't think that they've thought carefully about this, because it plays into their biases, ironically enough. and so that's why I just wanted to comment there. But
all right, well, hopefully people are pointed towards us on their podcast finding machine. That's all I hope for. Hopefully Overcast has a podcast recommending algorithm and we are at the top.
Exactly. Just recommend us and then we should be good. Well, this was a lot of fun, man. It was nice to have, like, a genuine debate after many episodes of the game.
So much agreement. Yeah,
cool.
Nice
to be continued.
All right, take care.